Susan, Butcher Box to the rescue. The other night we had some friends over for dinner and we had no idea what to make. And I was like, guess what? We have a freezer full of meat. So my husband went down and thawed out some chicken from Butcher Box and made the best coq au vin that we've had in a long, long time.
Yeah, you'd have been screwed without Butcher Box because I know you ain't got no time to go to the store right now.
That's true. I don't have time to go shop for meat or pick out the meat or find the best quality, low-priced meat. So ButcherBox does all of that for me.
So, true story, my husband's workplace has a Slack channel called Smoked Meats. And I know you can't like win a workplace conversation, but he is now because with Butcher Box, his great cuts of meat to the door, they can cook up and take photos of for his workmates.
I love ButcherBox, and I think other people would too.
ButcherBox is the ultimate convenience, delivered right to your doorstep, free shipping always, with curated, customized box plans.
It's 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork, raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
There are a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value with exclusive membership deals. They also provide recipe inspiration, guides, tips, and hacks.
Sign up at butcherbox.com/proof and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off.
Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/proof and use code PROOF to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order.
Hey everyone, before we continue with this episode, I want to tell you about another podcast. Have you ever wondered what it feels like to watch your house burn down or be attacked by an alligator or learn that your spouse hired someone to kill you? If you're dying to know, then What Was That Like is the podcast for you. What Was That Like is filled with real stories about the most surreal experiences of people's lives. On the show, host Scott Johnson dives deep with his guests into the unbelievable situations they found themselves in, like animal attacks, plane crashes, winning The Price is Right, and more. The show brings you tons of completely surreal, completely true stories, all told through the lens of the person who actually experienced it.
Check out some of these episodes about wild and gripping stories to gain some insight on what it was like to, say, be a professional bridesmaid or lose a leg in a shark attack.
Susan, I think you'd be a really good professional bridesmaid.
And you'd be really good at losing a leg in a shark attack.
Oh, gee, thanks.
So if you want to hear some disturbing and inspiring firsthand stories, you need to check out What Was That Like? Every story is thoroughly researched and fact-checked, so you know even the most bizarre tales are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Before we jump into Sidebar this week, we wanted to just give you all a little update on Lee Clark from season one and Joey Watkins from a season of Undisclosed. Both of them had bills go before the Georgia Senate last week seeking compensation for years of wrongful conviction. And unfortunately, we have to report that the bills did not pass in the Georgia Senate. They were seeking money for years that they spent in prison wrongfully and hoping to get something from the state for that. It did not work out for them. And I think Susan, Justin, and I are all heartbroken for them because we have come to know and love them. And we don't have all the details yet, so we don't want to speculate on why it didn't pass, but we're going to try and give everyone a more thorough update in the next week or two, and going to invite some people to come on and talk about why maybe it didn't go forward and what the next steps could be and how their fight can continue.
As we discussed before, in Georgia, compensation is not guaranteed. It has to be done by a bill passed by Georgia state government. And if it's not passed, there's no compensation. And, I mean, Joey and Lee spent decades behind bars for crimes they didn't do, should never have been convicted of. And trying to restart their lives now, that's not easy. It's really fucking hard. They are owed so much more than what Georgia would offer to compensate them. And they didn't even get that.
Yeah, I spoke briefly with Lee the sort of day of and the day after, and I wish I had some way to make him feel better because that was not fun for him. And
they're devastated. They're fucking devastated because after that many years and decades away, and they deserve so much more than they're getting. And the fight's not over, but there needs to be attention on this. And the politicians who are supporting their cause, I want to thank them. And I hope the voters in Georgia are paying attention.
We'll get some more details for everyone and get an update and get some people on the show to talk about it. Because I think it's important for everyone to know that, you know, the fight for your life doesn't stop just when you walk out the door. You gotta actually get your life back.
Hello and welcome to this week's Sidebar. We're here to discuss episode 12 of season 2 of Proof. And this week, we're discussing everything about Josh Burrows and our interviews with him.
Yeah, I mean, we say in the episode that it was actually our very first interview for season 2. And I remember driving down there to meet him, and we had no idea what to expect. We were kind of joking, like, it could be a very short season. Like, we could interview him and be like, okay, this is it. There's no story here. So we had no idea what we were walking into.
And poor Kevin's like getting our calls going, what the fuck is going on down there?
I remember you were both excited and then I was a little nervous and I made you sort of keep checking in with me. But it was interesting because everything for the season was going to sort of hang on this discussion with him and what he had to say. And it was one hell of an interview, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, Josh Burrows is a complicated guy, a lot going on there. But I will say he's a nice guy. Like, he's friendly, he's personable, he's nice to chat to.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely friendly and personable. And I think that's part of the reason maybe why I don't think anyone would call him believable. But
you want to find something to explain what he's saying.
Right. I know in the episode we use a clip of right after we interview him and I say, I'm like so confused. Was there really a party? And Susan, you're like, no, there was no party. But I just had this feeling like, okay, maybe it's not the party. Maybe it's not the Home Depot party, but he's talking about something that actually happened. Like, there has to be some element of truth in everything he's saying. So what party is he describing? Like, where is he going in his mind to pull information?
It is clear he's lying. That's not like a dispute. Like, everyone who talks to him will know instantly that he is lying. But the way he talks, the way he sells it,
he doesn't sound like he's searching for the truth when he talks.
No, he is very, he's not searching for anything.
So when he talks, like, there's not, I mean, I wasn't there, but listening to it and talking to you all after, he doesn't seem to come across as someone like, just with their cadence and when they're talking, like that there's something, you know, shifty or off about.
And when he's caught in lies, he's usually not deterred. Sometimes he gets caught off guard, but usually he's just adaptable.
Yeah, like when you pointed out that, you know, he had said that Stan was at this party and you pointed out, well, there's no way because Stan actually had an alibi. His response was, well, I'm trying the best I can. Like, it's like he feels like he has to tell us something, or just saying to us, I don't know, isn't an option. He feels compelled to give us a story.
The thing that stood out for me, he's basing everything he says, it seems, on other kind of memories and stories that he has, right? They're being sort of shaped around there somehow. And I don't know how to describe it. It doesn't feel like he's creating things out of thin air. He's sort of, he's altering things that may have happened to fit a particular theme or storyline or fact or something. And they all make sense. Like, his mother's beetle, right?
He clings to that. Like, he actually clings to that story. Like, that part, I think, is real. And he'll discard other real things. But that, like, part of the storyline, he clings to. Even though it is proof positive, what he's talking about could not have happened in May or June.
Yeah, he remembers it that way. And, you know, there's this feeling that the stuff with, like, his mother and a beetle, like, those would have been stories and memories that he had of other events. And so they sort of fit into how he's explaining this, it feels like.
Yeah. So I'm going to draw the obvious parallel. I think very much whatever's happening with Josh Burrows is absolutely Jay Wilds from Nonsided's case. Now, the difference is that Jay was several years older and working with the Baltimore police, who were quite a bit more equipped than the Manteca police were. But otherwise, I think that whatever sort of psychological condition that Jay and Josh Burrows have, it's the same situation. It's the same exact scenario. The only difference is that like Jay's stories are a tiny bit better and that the Baltimore police's coaching is a hell of a lot better. But the exact same thing is there. Like you tell them one thing, the next go around's incorporated. Tell them another, it's incorporated again. And around and around and around you go. And that's why to this day, Jay Wilds, if you talk to him today, he would say the same, well, he would not say the same shit. Correction. He would say different shit, but a version of the prior shit he said before.
Well, and I mean, we know that that is true for Josh. Like the story he told us was different than the story he said 23, almost 24 years ago, but similar enough, right? So
and it's like Jay Wilds. Jay Wilds gave a new story in like what, 2015, 2016? Mm-hmm. And it had the same whole theme, but like just totally new batshit version of it. And people are like, see, he's still saying that the non's guilty. I'm like, but there's also all this batshit he's just added to it. That's just like Josh Burrows and the pistol whip story.
Right. Pistol whipped and then woke up and saw blood all over the floor.
I told Jake about it. And usually he gets upset about this kind of stuff. And he just started laughing. He's like, where the fuck did the pistol come from?
Yeah. I mean, the thing with Josh, though, is someone online made a comment like feeling like he doesn't do it to hurt anyone. Right. He almost doesn't even realize that what he's saying could have consequences.
He's doing it to save himself.
I do think, though, that by the second time we interviewed, you know, as we were leaving, I do think, especially after he saw Jake's interrogation or clips of Jake's interrogation, I think it sunk in like, oh.
Did it sink in, though, or did he just feel it in the moment and forget it?
I don't know.
There was a funny moment, though, in our first interview with him, when I gave him a piece of paper and I was like, how about you show me where all this stuff happened? And he has the pen and he's kind of looking at us. And then he kind of like hesitantly draws like a rectangle. And he's like, that's what a Home Depot looks like, right?
Pretty much the exact same thing he did when he was 14 years old.
Yeah.
But two things from his interview stood out. The very first thing he said, or one of the very first things he said to us before we explained what we were doing or why we were there or anything, he says, Jake Silva should not be in prison.
And to back up a bit, usually when we talk to someone, like we show up on their doorstep and knock on their door and say, hey, we want to talk. Usually there are questions asked. Usually there is some kind of back and forth about like who we are, why we're there, something. There was basically none of that with Josh. We knock on his door, say, we want to talk about this case from Manteca in 2000. And he's like, cool, let's go to the Panera and talk there. Like that, I can't think of a time when that's happened before. So I feel very confident, actually, that he could not have had any indication why we're there to talk to him, what we wanted to ask. And still his like words like 2 minutes in after bragging about his skating abilities were, I don't think Jake Silva should be there.
Yeah, he just can't explain why he thinks that in a coherent fashion.
Well, Jake is guilty of pistol whipping him, but he never saw Jake hurting Renee.
Or Jake is guilty for not intervening.
Stopping it.
Yeah. But I mean, the bottom line is he also said to us, they told me he was there. They said Jake was there. And that's why when he saw the interrogation and Jake is like, I wasn't there. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. He was like, oh man, they told me he was there.
It really struck him. He's like, oh shit, man. Jake is saying for real, he wasn't there and he sounds believable.
And the whole thing, I mean, did you all sense that he was still traumatized by this all these years later?
I don't want to speculate too far. I do feel like Josh's road has not been an easy one in general, and this could just be like one more trauma to add to the list. If you're listening to this show, then I'm going to guess you're a fan of true crime podcasts. So in the mornings, grab your favorite mug and pour yourself a dose of spine-tingling true crime every AM with Morning Cup of Murder. It's a short daily show that's the perfect podcast to incorporate into your morning routine. In less than 15 minutes, you'll hear about a true crime that took place on today's date in history. Each day's dark history lesson will kickstart your morning with intriguing tales of murder, abduction, serial killers, cults, and more.
So, pour yourself a piping hot cup of murder every single morning with Morning Cup of Murder. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
So one thing we didn't talk about in the show is how the cops found Josh in the first place. And like, basically, long story short, after Renee's body was found, Josh had two separate incidents. He was joyriding. Stole a car with some friends, and they steal a car, get caught very quick, and they bring Josh and two of his friends down to the station to talk to them. And what happens after they're interviewed is they put two of the boys in a room together, like an interrogation room, and they say, oh, we're busy now, we're gonna leave you here, y'all two do your thing, it's cool. And the two boys are like, they can't hear us here, right? And they check the room for like a camera or recording device. And like, oh, it's fine. They can't hear us here. There's no sign of a recorder. Obviously, there is. We know this because there was a recorder and there's a transcript of it. But the two boys talk to each other about how they're good to go now. They're like, oh, we're fine. We're not going to juvie again for the car theft because we told them about Renee, what Josh told us about Renee. So we're all good now. And they compare notes. They're like, what'd you tell them Josh told you? And they're like, well, that's kind of what I told them Josh told us. And then they add Josh to the mix. So Josh is then brought to the same room, and the three of them are there going like, we're cool, right? Like, they're going to let us go and go smoke weed again because we told them about Renee. So that's how the cops learn Josh allegedly knows something about Renee. And they interrogate him for the first time in June of 2000. And he tells the story we referenced on the show about Steve Raimondo's uncle and a guy showing him photos of the party the night of the murder and sex noises and like the field. It's a whole thing. It's ridiculous. It's like, don't waste time worrying about it. But that's how they find him in the first place.
The very first time we went to Manteca, we were like, could Josh have been over at the Food for Less and heard sex noises over by the Home Depot? We were like, let's send Kevin over to the Home Depot to make sex noises.
We did, and Kevin wouldn't do it.
Kevin, you said no, you were going to decline that request.
We're like, yeah, this is scientific. We're going to stand at the Food for Less. You go to the Home Depot, make sex noises, and we'll see if we can hear you.
And the one thing that I remember is any interview that we did seemed like you both were asking whoever it was, do you think if you were standing over here, you could have heard sex noises at the Home Depot?
Just to the ones Josh said was there, but yes.
I mean, obviously that didn't happen. And the whole story is nuts, which is probably why, I mean, we say in the show, like, you know, it was Detective Morgan at the time. He looked into it. He checked it out. It didn't make sense to him. And he kind of moved on after that June interview with Josh.
I mean, this was a whole thing. There's like 100 pages in the file about it. And it's all meaningless because like, it's just not connected to reality until 3 months later when Morgan's off the case and Susan Wells are back on, they're in charge and they get the Home Depot party story, which as we hear on the show, wasn't even Josh's story. Like that story is not his. That came from a guy named Chris Williams, who is never mentioned again in the case because he just flat out wasn't competent to be a witness.
One of the interesting things for Josh, for me, was when you all explained to me that he could have been talking about another party. And that sort of caught me off guard when you first said it. And I guess that's what I was saying earlier about how lots of the stories that he tells or lots of the things he talks about in relation to Renee are taken from other sort of moments from his memory. And he puts them into this context.
I think there was truth. Someone was saying that we were so, I mean, they're not even truths, like, but there's some kind of reality sort of lurking somewhere below the surface. And it's hard to parse through and find it, or impossible to find it, until you find out more info. And His stories about a party in the vicinity of the Home Depot sound so ridiculous that I recall at the time, we're just like, what the fuck, Josh? But I think that was real. I think it was a real thing. He was trying to tell us something true and real in that moment, and we were just not receptive to it.
Well, I also think, though, it wasn't just that he was trying to tell us something new. I also think he was understanding for the first time ever what maybe happened. I actually think he believed that there was a party where Renee was killed. Like, I think he believed that. And I think he believed that, you know, Jake was there and they had evidence Jake was there. And he's putting all this together. Like, what the hell happened? You know, and just kind of an off the cuff remark. He's like, maybe it was a different party. Like, and I think he realized that I was at a party, a different party, and it's not the party they're thinking happened or claiming that happened. It's completely different. The Home Depot party never happened, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. So this is speculative, but it's one thing I keep going back to. We talked to Detective Morgan, who was the detective first in charge, talked to Josh for the first story. And we asked him about Josh Burroughs. And he's like, he kept talking about hearing noises south of Food for Less. And I didn't know what to make of that story. Something weird was going on there. I think in Morgan's head, he thought he like failed to get the real story or somehow failed to get the actual evidence, because he didn't doubt that Jake and Ty were guilty, but he knew he'd talked to Josh and gotten a strange story about this sound south of Food for Less. And I was kind of surprised at the time, because I'm like, what, the Food for Less is west of the Home Depot. So if Josh heard sounds from the Home Depot, he would have heard them from the east. And you're telling us in your memory now that Josh said he heard them south of the Food for Less. Well, this warehouse where we think the party could have actually happened, like where kids really were partying, it is south of Food for Less. To me, it's an indication that even back then, Josh may have known that there was another warehouse south of Food for Less that he's talking about.
And the confusing thing about this to understand is that we're not suggesting that Renee was killed at a different party or anything happened at this other party, but that there was perhaps another warehouse where kids would go to hang out and skate.
And one night, Josh was just there and partied. So he knew he was there. And when the police tell him, we have proof you were there, he believes it. But nothing happened. He saw nothing. He's just trying to escape the fact that he was at the party in his mind. And the police know he was there.
Right. And then when it comes time to trial and he realizes, oh, this is real, right? Like these people are going to be convicted because I said they were there. He tries to recant.
Halfway.
But he's still saying there was a party.
Yeah. He recants the murder, recants the rape, does not recant the party.
Because he is still believing that his handprints were found at some warehouse where he had been at a party. I don't know. Maybe we're reading too much into it.
No, I think that's like something like that. Something along those lines, I think very much must have happened. I mean, the exact sequence of like when he believed what or like, yeah, that's all a haze. But something like that happened.
The bottom line, though, is, you know, it really doesn't matter. Even if Josh today said to us, listen, there was never a party. I was never at any party. I never did, you know, which is pretty much what he has been saying. Mm-hmm. It won't make any difference to Jake at this point.
It won't. And plus, he is definitely committed to the idea that his mom picked up the beetle after the party. So there, hands down, whatever he's talking about, if it matters, it's not about Renee's death, because that was a month and a bit later.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff to unpack there. Seems to, sometimes it only gets more confusing to me, not less.
And it's kind of a minor note in the show, but one of the sort of tragedies of this case that I was struck by when we first learned it is that Josh Burroughs and Ty Lopes' daughter were friends. I mean, it makes sense. Like, she was 13, he was 14. They were the friends. Like, it wasn't Josh and like this group of skateboarding gangsters. Like, he implicated, I think unknowingly, one of his friends' dads.
I had actually forgotten that piece of information until it came back up again. And maybe because I wanted to forget it. I don't know. And just how hard that must have been for her all those years.
And to me, it does suggest that Josh was a little more calculating than maybe we're giving credit for. Because according to Mandy, like, she would go hang out with him all the time while her dad's facing trial and life in prison. She's hanging out with a star witness, hoping he'll say something that matters. And he literally never mentions it in her memory.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it was hard for her to hear this past episode. I think she also was hoping that Josh would just come clean about everything. And I think it kind of hurt her all over again.
He's still doing it.
Yeah. She said she'd like to interview him herself.
I mean, it's a lot of pressure on a kid like her, just hoping that he's going to say something that can help her father.
Yeah.
And it's her friend, though. Like, he was her friend before all this. Like, it's a double betrayal. Like,
yeah.
So that's it for Josh Burroughs' stories. We're not going back to that. I think that it is obvious. None of that happened. None of that matters. None of that's getting us closer to the truth. So going forward, we're looking at our investigation into what really happened. I'm going back to Manteca and looking into a story we kind of overlooked, which is the story about the house Pisana Avenue and the sisters who live there. And we finally sit down and talk to Tim Fisher, the man who Victoria, Lewis's mother, told us she thought would kill Renee.
You've been listening to Proof Sidebar, a podcast by Red Marble Media in association with Glass Box Media. Send us your questions and comments at proofcrimepod@gmail.com. Follow us everywhere with the handle @proofcrimepod and on our website, proofcrimepod.com. Regular episodes drop on Mondays, and you can find sidebars on Thursdays. Thanks so much for listening.